Hello and welcome to The Sacred. I'm Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about our deepest values, the stories that shape us, and how we can have better, more productive public conversations. My hope is that by listening to a really wide range of people from different religious and political perspectives, who come from different disciplines and interests, I can grow in empathy, get a better idea of what is driving some of the divisions in our common life. As always, please do rate, review, and share the podcast, because we are now, of course, all slaves to the algorithm. And if our new overlords can see that you are enjoying the podcast, they think others might too, and recommend it. Speaking of recommendations, I wanted to give you lovely sacred listeners a bit of advance warning about a new podcast project from Theos, coming this autumn. Reading Our Times, presented by our senior fellow, Nick Spencer, explores the books and ideas that are shaping us today. The first teaser episode with Michael Sandel will be available in September, so do follow the Theos or the Sacred social channels and we'll let you know as soon as it is available. In this episode of The Sacred, you'll hear a conversation I had with Dr. Miriam Francois. Miriam is a journalist, filmmaker, and senior fellow at the Center for Global Policy, which is an American think tank working on the intersection of US foreign policy and Muslim geopolitics. She's made radio and television documentaries for the BBC, Sky, and others, and presented a range of programs related to religion. She's currently running the website and podcast, We Need to Talk About Whiteness. We spoke about the process that led to her embracing Islam after university, her experiences as a white woman in a headscarf, and why she will no longer take part in debates which she calls religious bear baiting. I really hope you enjoy listening. Miriam, thank you so much for coming to have a chat with me. You've had a bit of warning about the big opening question. What do you hold sacred? What are your sacred values? And get a whole wide range of responses to this. Some people want to challenge the premise. For some people, it's really natural language. What bubbled up for you as you've had a little bit of time to think about this concept of what's sacred to you?
Yeah. So I think I would probably say that I have a sacred framework, of which there are obviously a few interconnected values within that. And then I was thinking about how do I sum up that framework, which is complex. It's obviously an Islamic framework of reference. But the easiest way I could think of referring to it would be to quote a saying of the Prophet, peace be upon him, who says, it was also an inscription on his sword. And it says, forgive him who wrongs you, join him who cuts you off, do good to him who does evil unto you, and speak the truth, even if it be against yourself. And I feel that within that saying is encapsulated for me the heart of what it means to be a Muslim. And the key principles that I try and abide by in my life, not always successfully, but certainly they're sort of the key stars in the map that I seek to follow in my spiritual journey.
That's beautifully put. I'm gonna wind the tape back a little bit. Sometimes when we ask about people's childhood and their journeys, how they got to those sacred things become clear, sometimes not. But I'd love you to say a bit about your childhood, and particularly if there were any big ideas in the air, whether they were religious or political or philosophical, that you feel have been formative for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think our childhoods are certainly much more formative than maybe a lot of people are willing to consider in terms of how we forge our outlooks as adults. For me, my outlook, I think, is very much grounded in my identity, which is multi-layered. Everyone's is multi-layered, but I would say that growing up, I was born in Camden in London. I grew up in at the heart of multicultural London, at the height of multiculturalism, when very much unlike today, multiculturalism was considered to be a sort of pioneering principle within Europe, where the dominant narrative was assimilationist when it came to the integration debate, as it were. And so I very much grew up aware that my identity was one of many, that I was a hybrid identity, being Franco-Irish, growing up in London with friends from all over the world. And with that awareness, I think, has come a level of respect for the different cultures that make up the multivaried notion of what is Britishness today. So I would say growing up in multicultural London, I would say being French, being part of a culture that has revolution at its heart, that has notions of public protest as key principles of political life. You know, I frequently joke that, you know, I come from a culture where people will get out on the streets because of the price of apples. And I live in a country where people can have something as momentous as Brexit happening. And there's, you know, from my perspective, hardly a peep. And so I feel that that has created a level of distance between my self perception and the culture that I live in. You know, I identify as a Londoner, but I don't think I can identify as British because I still see Britain with an element of distance. I identify as a Londoner, however, which, you know, I think may be understandable to those who know London well. And then finally, I would say being Irish, you know, being Irish is to me being connected to one of the British colonies. It's being part of a culture that was on the hard end of some of the most brutal aspects of British imperialism. It's being connected to a narrative of Britishness that remains largely unheard. You know, my great grandfather was killed by the Black and Tan. He was part of the IRA. He was part of what many would regard as the legitimate resistance against British imperialism at the time. And that has inevitably forged how I perceive myself and how I perceive the story we tell about what Britain is, what Britain stands for, what our history is in this country. And I think also has impacted on my relationship with others who also may share a skepticism with regards to official narratives around, you know, British values, as it were, or Britishness.
Yeah. That is so interesting. Two revolutionary bloodlines coming through you. There was some Roman Catholicism around in your childhood, is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. My mum is Irish Catholic. My Irish side of my family are all, you know, practicing Catholics. I think the French side of my family is more sort of secular Catholic, so it's more of a tradition, and I think perhaps less of a spiritual tradition in that sense. It's more, I would describe it more as folklore, whereas I think in Ireland there is still more of a connection in my experience to, at least in my family, and where my family's from, which is Leitrim, to a faith that is considered to be an integral part of people's identity beyond the folklore, that there is a guidance to be found within scripture, that God is still a presence in day-to-day life, and certainly nothing to be ashamed of, which I think is certainly very different in more secular cultures, whether that's Britain or France. They're different, but there's still, I think, in these cultures, the dominant narrative of secularism, which passes for neutrality, is in fact a framework which encourages people to minimize the extent to which they can express the spiritual or religious part of their identity, of our identity.
Yeah.
So yes, Roman Catholicism absolutely was. And actually one thing I really wanted to say, because it comes up a lot in my life, is people sort of say, well, you know, why would you turn your back on Catholicism to become a Muslim? That is absolutely not how I perceive being a Muslim. Being a Muslim for me is an extension of everything I believed as a Catholic, and is I see it as an enrichment of everything that I previously believed. Catholicism had quite a lot of leeway. You know, Islam is there are some pretty set principles in terms of what you have to do. Not everyone does do them, but they're there. And maybe my personality is such that I did need a bit more constraints to keep me in check.
A bit more structure. I remember reading a really interesting article about, and I can't remember what it was, but it was a famous atheist writer who suddenly acknowledged that in an incredibly kind of choice-ridden and sexually free culture, which particularly for women can not always feel as free as it is advertised, is it any wonder that some young people actually really do like the idea of some structure, of restraint in our relationships with each other, of a community and a story to be a part of? It was a real it was one of those real moments of intellectual honesty that I found very helpful.
Yeah. Well, I think sometimes when we talk about absolute freedom, sorry to cut you,
No, please.
I think actually what we're talking about is a very crass veneer for chaos. And ultimately, when we talk about freedom is usually exists within constraints. It's freedom from constraints. It's not freedom without any constraints. And I personally think that there is also freedom to be found in constraints. And that's what a lot of spiritual traditions teach us, that actually the true freedom isn't this idea of you just do whatever you want, whenever you want, whatever you want. It's actually that you will find a much deeper sense of freedom, a much more emancipatory form of freedom, in finding a symbiosis between yourself, your soul, and whatever you want to call it, God, the universe, the life force, the source. Some people call it nature, whatever you need to call it, you know. But there is a freedom that is a much more substantive one that is to be found there, and a much more liberating one. I think the alternative of the sort of capitalist version of freedom is the freedom to consume, and the freedom to be a consumer, and therefore to be sold. I won't use foul language, but you know, any knickknacks that can basically be imposed upon you to define your identity for you, because you've got no identity, because you are without constraints, you are without frameworks. It's freedom, but freedom to be defined by the entities within our world that are constantly seeking to define you.
Yeah, there's a bit in New Testament that is done very much paraphrasing, but basically says you're going to be a slave to something. Like, you're going to be a slave to your own worst instincts, or you can be a slave to God, who is, you know, who knows what you fully alive looks like. I want to come back to Islam, but I want to just get a sense a bit of your kind of adolescent years. You ended up going to Cambridge. I'm afraid I don't know what you studied initially. I know what your later study was.
Yeah, I did social and political sciences at Cambridge.
Right.
Yeah. Cambridge was a culture shock.
Yeah, I was going to ask, because, you know, I don't know much about the setting you came from, but were you from one of those families that it was really obvious that that's what you were going to do and people had gone ahead of you, or was it a bit more blazing a trail?
So I have two brothers, neither of whom went to university. Well, my second brother went but didn't finish university. He went to Bournemouth. Within my family, I would say that there was an expectation that we would go to university, but certainly there's no one else that had gone to Oxbridge. And, you know, Oxbridge held the allure, I think, that it does for people who are outside of it. You know, it loses it, thankfully, once you're there. You know, the scales will fall from your eyes once you're in there. But from afar, the mystique of it was definitely something that everyone was really proud, I guess, to think that I would be going there. And what I hadn't really banked on was that I found the environment at Cambridge to be deeply, I need to choose my words wisely, it was a very uncomfortable experience for me. I did not recognize myself in the sort of hierarchies of what was considered to be valuable, which was rooted in very traditional British upper class notions of, whether it was in the kind of sports you practiced, the way you dressed, the way you spoke, what kind of social events you attended. And I was not familiar with that world. And if you're not versed in elitist moors, and I would have had some exposure to elitist moors, just in my, you know, through my life, through living in London, through some of my friends, but I still was not immersed in that world as normal. And that, so that was a bit of a shocker, but by the second year, right, I'd made some friends. I was playing varsity basketball. I, you know, met people playing tournaments outside. I'd found a group of French people in Cambridge, most of whom were Muslim, in fact. And that was really the beginning of a conversation that eventually led me to embrace Islam. Yeah.
I'd love to hear a bit more about that in your own words. And I know that, well, you have said in the past, not really liking the word about being a revert or a convert. Or so I'd love to hear what is the language you do prefer. And, yeah. You know, how did you go from presumably not, you know, having exposure to Islam through living in London, but feeling like this was the identity that you wanted to embrace for yourself?
Yeah, well, ironically, I didn't. I often say that I became Muslim despite myself, to break those questions down, I suppose the first part was I grew up with a lot of Muslims. You know, my best friends from school, I attended a French school in London. I had a lot of friends who were French Muslims, of a variety of backgrounds. My closest friends are Moroccan, and so Islam was not an alien religion to me. I think it's really important to clarify that, because for a lot of people who have got no exposure to Islam, you know, it's something from afar, like, oh my gosh, it would be such a leap. It wasn't a leap. My friends fasted when I was younger. I went round to their houses. Their mum wore hijab. They prayed. We took off our shoes. Like, it was not unfamiliar to me. I stopped eating pork when I was 12. I didn't, you know, because most of my friends didn't eat pork. I just didn't, you know, I actually tried to go vegetarian, but that's another story. And so what really happened is that while I was at uni, 9/11 happened, and the conversation around Muslims and Islam changed pretty dramatically. So that pretty much overnight, there was a very palpable hostility towards Muslims that I felt and took personally, because when you were talking about Muslims, you were talking about my closest friends, you were talking about my friend's mum, you were talking about, you know, my friend's dad, who was the cook at our school, who used to always give me extra servings. Like, you know, it was something I couldn't help but have to take a stand on. It wasn't possible to stay neutral. The only issue was that I didn't know much about Islam. I knew much about Muslims because I had loads of Muslim friends, but Islam as a faith, I was not hugely familiar with. And so what would happen is I'd get into debates, as you do in Cambridge, with people who would then throw things at me and say, well, it says this in the Quran, doesn't it? And I'd say, does it? Does it really? Okay, I probably should go away and find out if that's true. And so I ended up just going away and doing some homework, some proper homework. I went to the library, you know, I went to the library, I read some books. I didn't just read the Quran. I went and read around the Quran. I read a lot of literature around the history of Islam. I read Martin Ling's Fritjof Schwann. I read Guy Eaton. I read Tariq Ramadan. And as I was going through this information, I, having been educated as a Catholic, I was very much thinking, completely agree. And I didn't find any point at which I blocked. You know, there was no point at which I read something and thought, oh my God, you know, I can't possibly subscribe to that. And eventually what happened is I read the Quran. I read a translation of the Quran in French, it's a revelation. It spoke to me the only way that revelation can, you know, that it spoke directly to my heart. And it was a really profoundly important and critical form of guidance for me at that point in my life. And I say that I was Muslim despite myself, because when I finished all of this studying and reading of the Quran, I suddenly realized that, oh, now that I believe all of this stuff I've been reading, because I hadn't set out to become a Muslim, I was like, oh gosh, now I'm a Muslim. I didn't know I was getting into this. This isn't what I'd planned. And you asked me actually why I don't like the terms reverts or converts. It's because the earliest Muslim community was a community of converts. You know, they weren't Muslim prior to that. But when they converted, they just became Muslim. And so when I started looking into who actually gets called a convert, who actually gets a revert, I've been a Muslim my entire adult life. You know, I'm 37 years old. I became Muslim when I was 21. To me, to continuously refer to me as a convert is to situate me at age 21 at that time. I've been Muslim. I've been Muslim for a minute. You know, I don't need to be categorized as a different kind of Muslim. And in addition to that, it became obvious to me that the people who were being described as converts or reverts tended to be white. So if you were a black convert to Islam, you're just Muslim. You know, I mean, it's almost expected of you. But if you're a white Muslim, oh, mashallah, you're a revert. You are a revert sister. You could be 60 years old and white in the mosque. You're still a revert. Come on now. But this is, to me, a hierarchy within our religious community that is fundamentally at odds with what the Prophet, peace be upon him, taught us about human equality. And it's also an ugly reflection of internalized forms of European ethnocentrism, racism, which I feel very strongly that I want no part of.
Yeah, thank you. You've written a little bit about, and I know it comes up in your podcast and your writing around whiteness, about that shift when you embrace Islam and were wearing a headscarf, you used the phrase, suddenly you are off white, which I really love. This sense that your public presence, your visibility, the kind of semiotics of the way people read you really shifted. What was that experience like, sort of emotionally, psychologically, and now kind of having had more time to process it?
Yeah. So when I began wearing a headscarf, which was pretty much immediately when I was 21, what immediately happened, and it was as immediate as putting on a scarf and walking out my door to the bus stop, was that I experienced a form of latent hostility, which I'd never experienced as a white blonde woman walking down the street in my day-to-day life. And that palpable hostility manifested itself in every facet of my life. It would manifest itself when I would get on the bus and I'd be verbally abused by a fellow passenger. It would manifest itself when I would go to interview for a job that I'd done for 3 summers already in a row and got turned down for the job with no explanation. It would manifest itself when I would meet new people and the questions would be constantly about trying to situate me with the implicit understanding that I was not from here. You know, where are you from? You've got a bit of an accent. Where are you from? And I'd be like, do I? Well, I mean, do you mean a London accent? They'd be like, no, I can hear something a bit foreign in there. Can you? And I'd be like, French, maybe? No, it's not that. And I'm like, what? You know, you know, people are fishing for some kind of, you know, non-European form of identification that they can use to locate you outside of us. There is us. And we know you're not us. You look a bit like us, but we know you're not us. And that was something that I experienced very, very clearly and opened my eyes to what I would call a two-tier system. And it's very difficult for people who are racialized as white to understand that there is a two-tier system because you don't ever see it. You know, you might hear about it from people secondhand. But honestly, and I'm experiencing the off-white version, which looks nothing like the darker skin tone version of that same experience. You know, my version is the light version of what happens. and being aware of that made me feel a momentous responsibility for being actively involved in challenging the underpinning which allowed people to feel like they could impose their perceptions of belonging or non-belonging onto me in a way that would make me feel like an outsider. I'd be followed around shops, like I said, verbal abuse, the questions about origins, the question, so where's your father from? Does your father make you wear that? You know, I mean, if anyone didn't make me wear it, it would definitely be my dad. You know, if anyone didn't want me wearing it, it would be my dad. So implicit also within that is certain assumptions about brown and black folk, you know, and about how they treat their women or about how women are within that culture, which also was sort of a smack in the face of like, right, okay, so without knowing anything about me, you think you know me. That is what people who are excluded from whiteness are confronted with every day. And, you know, the whole having to speak on behalf of your entire group, you know, whether it's in all black people, in my case, it was, you know, being asked to speak on behalf of all Muslims at all times, is both exhausting and reductive.
Yeah. I'm interested in this question just for the sake of it, but also in how it relates to what we've just been talking about, because there's been these twin threads in your career, journalism and a kind of academic policy and analyst, both of which have intersected with Islam and with other religions and geopolitics. What are the threads you've been pulling at? What is the, if there is a sense of vocation or conviction that's led you into those fields?
Yeah, so I would say that the threads are the desire to tell stories that I feel need to be heard. And for me, that's what drives me. What drives me is an awareness that there are narratives that are vitally important to our common identity, to the balance of who we are as a nation, or as a global community, and that my awareness of them, or the blessing of being having insights into worlds that may otherwise be little understood, carries with it a responsibility to ensure that those voices and perspectives are heard. I love writing, and I love making films about issues that are close to my heart. The academia for me has been a way of grounding myself so that I come at subjects with a thorough, or at least I hope it, I try to have a thorough awareness of what it is that I'm talking about, you know, that I'm not unaware of the structural issues surrounding them, that I'm not unaware of the histories, that I'm not coming at these issues as, you know, with a voyeurism that isn't always actually helpful. Mm-hmm. In these areas.
I wanted to ask you about the tension that, and I'm definitely projecting on this, but at reading about you and thinking about your work, I felt a sense of familiarity, or at least a kind of parallel, in the sense that one of the things I'm trying to do in my work is to be in some form, some way, a public Christian, to be a woman who is a follower of Jesus and wants to kind of help freshen up the understanding of what Christianity looks like, of what it means, of what these communities of belonging and these stories are about in public, but also someone who runs a think tank who wants to do research that is just rigorous, informative about the role of faith in public life and has a quite strong kind of academic background. And sometimes it feels like those two things are difficult to hold together, that some people want me to be more Christian or more spokesperson-y, more I represent this. And some people say, well, that's just getting in the way of doing good research or doing good objective commentary. You need to leave that bit and be more, you know, more academic, more objective, more rigorous, and religion can't possibly mix with that. So these two things, and I believe fiercely that no one comes from nowhere. Everyone has lenses. There is no such thing as objectivity. And so being open about where you're coming from is helpful. But I do feel sometimes it's an uncomfortable place to be. And I wondered if it was the same.
It is, actually. I think whiteness is one of the symptoms of whiteness is believing that your identity is somehow neutral and irrelevant to the conversation. And so it's with complete agreeance with you that I share a concern with anyone who believes that you can leave your identity at the door. No, you cannot. No one leaves their identity at the door. There's just certain identities who, by virtue of being the dominant ones, are less visible to you as a dominant group. Now, for me, the tension is in several ways. I mean, one is I don't think I ever set out to be a public Muslim. I set out to, embark on a career. And as I did, in media, and as I did, unfortunately, because of what was happening geopolitically around us, and specifically, let's be honest, we're talking about the, terrorism. We're talking about also then from terrorism and narrative around an implicit assumption of an incompatibility between Islam and broader British or European values, which continues to be a dominant narrative in our society. And as a Muslim who, lives here, it felt like someone needs to, at least carry a bucket of water to try and put out the fire, and then that's kind of the least I could do. However, as I did embark on sort of trying to counter some of these polemics, which, took the form of debates, etc., it became very obvious to me that I was being reduced to one aspect of my identity. So I, became, in some people's eyes, like a spokesperson for Muslims. I am not a spokesperson for anyone but myself, and I never have been. I never would want to be. I understand that we live in a celebrity obsessed culture in which everybody is looking for someone to look up to. But the more you idealize someone, the harder you will fall. There are no people out there who are going to live up to the icon status that you have placed upon them. And in many ways, it's actually very dangerous to abdicate your sense of critical thinking in order to hand that over to someone you don't even know, but who you perceive to be a good representative for whatever reason. So that on one hand was something that I went through. And at a certain point, I made a very proactive decision to say, I'm no longer going to participate in debates about Islam and Muslims. One of the reasons wasn't just to do with that. It was also to do with the fact that I felt that we were on a cyclical bandwagon of stories, which whilst I initially perhaps naively had entered into them in the belief that we could advance the conversation, I then have come to the conclusion that these are actually forms of infotainment. And so their ultimate goal is not to move us forward as a society. They're actually forms of bear baiting. Religious bear baiting is how I regard some of the shows that I used to participate in. Yeah. And I will not be the one sent into dance monkey dance for those who consider themselves to be above us, because these sort of backward people of faith with their bizarre little norms. I mean, it's a very imperialist perspective which continues to dominate a lot of the religious programming that I have in the past participated in. So there's that. And then obviously there's the dichotomy in our culture between that's created by secularism, the idea that there is a need to separate the religious from the worldly, that actually society requires that. I don't necessarily subscribe to that. I would say that the principles that are core to my being manifest in everything that I do, even if I don't always abide by them. And what I mean by that is they may arise in a situation where I think, that's what I should be doing. And then I very frequently I will do the exact opposite. God forgive me, but that is, you know, I'm not going to try and pretend that I'm a saint. I'm not, but I can't leave my religion at the door. Who are these people? You know, it seems bizarre to me as a notion. I think that it actually leads to a slightly schizophrenic culture, where on one hand we have this view that there are religious people who live in religious perfection and bubbles of perfect religious bliss, and then on the other hand we have the worldly, full of temptation and wrongdoing. And I'm not in either of those worlds. I'm you know, a human who, you know, slides between the different light and dark within my soul. And so I can't be separated off or, you know, truncate a part of myself in order to make people who think this way because of historical reasons comfortable.
Yeah. I want to come on to talk about whiteness, because you have a podcast called We Need to Talk About Whiteness, and you've written about it and you've used the word several times in the conversation. And I think for a lot of listeners, it's a reasonably new concept. It feels like maybe a conversation that's been quite live in academia and in the States, but has been really pushed up the agenda by the moment around Black Lives Matter and other things. And I know, because of conversations we've had in the office, that people will have quite strong and quite differing reactions to the word and the concept. So I'd love to hear your kind of summary of what it is, and why do you think it's important? Why do you think it's a useful framework for right now?
Yeah. So first off, I think when people hear whiteness, they often think I mean white racial identity. I don't, and that's really important to clarify. I also should point out that there is no such thing as white racial identity. Race is a construct. It was a construct rooted in power. So the use of the term white to refer to people emerged in the context of slavery, that is to distinguish indentured servants from what would end up being slaves. So the indentured servants being poor Europeans who were branded white in order to align them with basically the 1% of the time, the wealthy European landowners, and to separate them off from their fellow indentured slaves at the time, indentured servants at the time who they were rebelling with. So there was a rebellion, if you want to call it that, of the indentured servants. Together, poor Europeans and Africans who shared very similar working conditions. The use of the term white was there to create a division between them and to ensure that those who were separated off as white could serve out their time and gain their freedom. And those who were excluded from being white, now being termed black, were now deemed to be slaves for life. Now, that's why for me, white is a category of power. It is not a racial category. It doesn't exist. It's a category of power. Whiteness is all of the structures of power that have flowed from that initial categorization of that first group of people as whites. So if you can think about it from that initial moment, from Bacon's Rebellion in the 17th century, we're talking about the first group of people that are being referred to as white in that context. Then what happens? That group of white people eventually become free. They earn a wage. They can buy land. During all of this time, people who are excluded from white are what? Slaves. So that they're not accruing any of that. Meanwhile, even poor white people are accruing what? Freedom. Then a bit of a wage. Then a little bit of land. Then a bit of land that you can hand down to people. Then a home. A home that you can hand down to people. Then a little bit of savings. Maybe a saving that you hand down to people. All of these things. Now, in addition to that, so that's just the economic side, which was the impetus originally, but associated with that was a whole body of ideas, of philosophy, pseudoscience, which essentially served to legitimate the idea that white people, people who are racialized as white Europeans, were somehow a superior group of people. And this was manifest in all aspects of European culture. Some of the people we consider to be cornerstones of British cultural thought, Virginia Woolf, Churchill, Darwin, were people who subscribed to these perceptions of Europeans as being a superior group. And that then trickled down into everything from literature, art, philosophy, pseudoscience, you know, the first center for eugenics having been set up here by Darwin's very own cousin at UCL. And so whiteness for me is all of those structures that have created a hierarchy of human value within our society, rooted in that first historical injustice, which happened, let's remind it, in what we should call British America. Because today we think of America as like a very different place, but it was British America, right? It was one of the British colonies. And so for me, when I talk about whiteness, I'm talking about structures. I'm talking about structures of inequality in our society that are grounded in a perception of a hierarchy of human worth that is very much rooted in European philosophy and ideals.
Thank you. We're tight on time. Otherwise, there is so much that I would love to unpack with you there. Maybe we can circle back. But I want to finish with a question that I ask everyone. And the more I ask it, the more I realize there's an absurdity to it, because everyone balances on so many axes and is so multi-layered in their identities. But part of the reason people listen to The Sacred is to hear new voices and to understand better perspectives that they might not be coming from, and learn how we can engage better, even if we're different, even if we disagree. So I'm going to let you choose what you want to say it about, but whether it's about, you know, something you wish people understood about Islam, or even just your Islam, you know, your faith that they don't, or something about whiteness. What is the thing you'd like the listener to go away that would really equip them to be engaging in these conversations with more empathy, more patience, less ignorance?
Probably I'd want to say that there's a lot of confusion around what we believe as Muslims. And a lot of the time people will then just pick up a random copy of the Quran and pick out a verse and say, boom, this thing here. So as Muslims, we believe that the Quran is the literal word of God. We believe it is the literal word of God that was revealed through the Archangel Gabriel to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. However, just because we believe it to be the literal word of God does not mean that it should be taken literally. It's a really, really, really important point, because actually literalist interpretations of textuality in Islam, and of narrow textuality, because, you know, the Quran is just one text, you know, that Muslims refer to, is a modern phenomena within our community. There were heretical groups that were literalists within history. You know, there were these little sects that were identified as sects and were often isolated because of their literalism. But today, you know, the petrodollar has basically allowed a very literalist and archaic and profoundly damaging understanding of Islam that I would call a sect. You know, some people call it Wahhabism, but essentially would have remained a sort of heretical desert sect had it not been for petrodollars. And it's really important to remember that, because that's not how Islam was understood historically by the majority of Muslims, nor will I do I firmly believe that in the future that people will regard that as a good indication of Islam. I think it will be regarded as a heresy that was allowed to hijack the faith because of money, and the devastation that has wrought on us as Muslims is almost unfathomable. And most Muslims, at least I'll speak for myself, I believe that what we are supposed to take from the Quran is what we, it's called Maqasid al-Sharia, which is the higher principles of the Quran. So anytime you see a ruling in Islam, that ruling was given in a context. What we seek to understand as Muslims is not how do we apply that rule as it was said then today. No. We say, what was God's objective in revealing that ruling at that time in that context? And how can you be truest to the principle that he was trying to get us to understand through that ruling? And how can you apply that true principle in the best way possible for people today in their lives, relative to everyone's specific situation?
Yeah, Francois, thank you so much for speaking to me on The Sacred.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
And a pleasure for me too.
Thank you for listening to The Sacred. I'm Elizabeth Oldfield. The producer of this episode is Soup Shop Productions, and it is a project of the think tank Theos. We'd really love to hear your thoughts, whether via Twitter at sacred_podcast or me at
TheosElizabeth or thesacredpodcast@gmail.com if it's easier to write in long form. As always, please do rate and share so others can find the podcast. We're also now available on Spotify, so it's even easier to take The Sacred with you wherever you go. Finally, if you'd like to know more about the work of Theos, you can connect via the website at theosthinktank.co.uk.